So I'm Lisa Detmer, and I'm here today with Lisa Marie Rollins. She is a performance artist, scholar, and so I just wanted to talk to you about your show. You have a show called Ungrateful Daughter, One Black Girl's Story of Being Adopted into a White Family That Aren't Celebrities. And I see it's also directed by a very well-known director, Kamau Bell. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The show is a solo theater performance or a one-woman show. And I've been working on it for about 3 years now. I started the play after starting my blog, A Birth Project. And I started my blog to basically talk about what it was for me growing up as a black girl and now being a grown black woman in a white family, and to share my experiences with that, and then also to share my experiences searching for my birth family and looking for other adoptees who were going through the same thing. And I came across this amazing adoptee community, and a lot of the adoptees were Korean adoptees and Vietnamese adoptees, and they just completely embraced me and were completely validating to my experience and telling me, you know, we've had the exact same experiences. The transracial adoption is this extreme experience of race and power, at the same time really complex because love and family and parents are all involved in that. And so there was a lot of validation. And then I started AFAD, my organization, which I know we'll talk about later, but it's a adoptee organization for black adoptees, same race and transracial adoptees and foster care alumni. So we provide support for adoptees. But as I was writing my blog, I signed up for a solo performance class with Kamau Bell. Mm-hmm. And
the comedian.
And I am a poet and a writer and have been for many, many years. But to begin writing for the stage was this huge, amazing translation of language that I really enjoyed because it allowed me to work in with characters and dialogue, and also to write this story that I've been writing for many years in poems or in journal entries or short stories or memoir, and to have it acted out on stage. It just became a really, really powerful way of expressing some of the issues that are important for transracial and international adoptees.
So it sounds like it was cathartic for you?
It was very cathartic. Mm-hmm. It was very cathartic. And I remember, you know, many times, I remember the first time that I was going to perform the show, the rehearsal the day before, I think I cried all the way through the first rehearsal. It's a comedic, satirical piece.
Right.
And so it vacillates between really dramatic moments and really comedic moments, and which is one of the gifts that I think that Kamau as a director brings to the piece.
And this issue is like all over the internet, the celebrity scene. Angelina Jolie, Nicole Kidman, Madonna have all adopted black children. And now Sandra.
Oh, Sandra. Yeah.
The stand-up Sandra. And so, I mean, this is like a very public issue that you only hear from the point of view of these celebrities. So it's like you never get to hear the other side, right?
And which is one of the reasons why I think the piece has been receiving a lot of support, not only from adoptees themselves, but from adoptive parents who don't necessarily see themselves in the same way as the celebrities are portrayed on television. And so I think that a lot of adoptive parents that are allies to their children now are actually very public about the ways that they try to struggle with race because they understand how race impacts their family. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's part of why the response has been what it's been, is because people are really glad to have a different perspective. And it's not an oppositional perspective, it's just a more complex one.
Right. Well, it's your personal life, too. I mean,
it is.
And like at one point, you talk about how your mom was expecting an Asian mixed baby and ended up with a black baby.
And actually,
how did you find out about that?
Well, I asked them why they wanted to adopt a child of color or why they wanted to adopt me. And my mom said, well, you know, at that time, you know, that we knew that there was a lot of Asian children that were needed adoption and needed support. And so when we went to the adoption agency, we asked for an Asian mixed child because we knew that mixed children also were, at that time, were not necessarily accepted by society. However, the adoption agency took it, and I talk about this in my show, the adoption agency actually hid the fact that I was Black and wow. falsified my records and put on that I was Filipino, Caucasian, Mexican, and white, and which is, you know, I am Filipino and Black, mm-hmm. but, you know, as I was growing up, my entire life, I'm, you know, I walk down the street and people treat me as a Black woman. People don't right. treat me as a Mexican, Filipino, Caucasian, you a know, mix. So exactly. So it was also, I think, a challenge for my parents because they're very much going by the documentation. And then all of a sudden to realize that they have a Black child and they have to actually adjust their lives to. And that isn't to say that parents who have Asian children don't have to pay attention to race, right. first of all. So mm-hmm. I just want to make that clear. But I think it was definitely a challenge for them, particularly when I began to identify and assert myself as a Black woman.
And confusing for you, too, I can imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When people are saying to you, you're not black, and then you walk out into the world and everyone is telling you you're Black and treating you as if you're Black in the racist ways. And so it absolutely is was a challenge, which is one of the reasons why I do the work that I do and work with the youth that I work with now. They talk to me constantly about the ways that their parents are able or aren't able to be allies to them in trying to figure out what it means to be Black. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important for white parents who have children of color to make sure that they're getting support and that their community actually reflects their family.
And so then you've got the whole celebrity thing coming along, mm-hmm. and that must really add to the mix of this whole cultural discussion. And then you were on Don Lemon on CNN. Oh, how was that?
I was on CNN with Don Lemon and
this woman who was on with you, she actually had the nerve. I saw part of it. She said, well, we should be thankful that there's these progressive white people who are willing to take in these babies and we should all be Americans. And Don Lemon, who's African-American right. or mixed or something, said, okay, you know, we live in a multicultural world now. Mm-hmm. That must have really been hard.
So one of the things about Dr. Walsh's experience is that she has mixed race children. And I think that one of the challenges for me is that I know very well that mixed race identity and transracial adoptive identity are two different things. And while they're similar things, if you are a mixed race child in a transracial adoptive family, yes. But if you are a quote unquote monoracial child in a transracial adoptive family, there's not the same kind of issues going on there. Because regardless of whether or not you are a different race than your mother and you are born to your mother, there's still a family history that you have access to. There is still a sense of belonging. There's still a sense of family that's different from an adoptive family. And that isn't to say that adoptees don't claim every parts of what it means to be in an adoptive family. It's to say that there's just adoption has a particular kind of impact in terms of lineage and the way that we connect with our families and with our histories. Mm-hmm. And so to argue that the mixed race experience is exactly the same, I think it was just really, really challenging for me to hold it together because I was like, no. And then also when they were when Don Lemon said that about multiculturalism as well, I really was like, yeah, we are definitely more multicultural, but that doesn't.
And you brought up the point in there how being in a white family doesn't necessarily mean that that family's involved in a diverse atmosphere, even.
Yeah.
No matter what their intentions are.
And which is one of the things that I find actually most powerful about transracial adoptive families that live in the Bay is that they think that somehow by osmosis, because they live in San Francisco or they live in Oakland and it's really, mm-hmm. really diverse and it's okay and our children is going to be fine, are going to be fine because they live here. But they don't have any adults of color in their life, or mm-hmm. they don't have any adults of color in their church or in, you know, their doctors, or they could basically spend their entire day moving from place to place and it's majority white people. And so what is the message that you're sending to your child about your comfort level with people of color? And then at the same time, you have adopted and you clearly love a child of color, but what does that tell me as a child
right.
about my ability to be comfortable with other people of color and also adults of color? And I really experienced that as a child as well. I mean, growing up in a place that was really, really isolated and completely disconnected. My community was, but I was in a really diverse city. I grew up in Tacoma, Washington, which is, Seattle, Tacoma, and it's mm-hmm. a lot like the whole San Francisco, Oakland. Mm-hmm. Oakland's where all the black people are. You know, Tacoma's where all the black people are. But when I was growing up, that wasn't my experience. Our church community, our, school community, all of the places that we live, they were all majority white communities. And so that sense of isolation for me as a person of color was extraordinary, and particularly because also everyone else didn't have any interactions with people of color. So everything, all of their ideas about what it meant to be a person of color was projected onto me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, some of that actually comes out in the play.
Yeah. Also,
and
let's get back to the play because
sure.
You talk about, I don't know if this is what you're going to talk about, but at one point you talk about how your mother cut off your hair, not knowing what to do with your hair being so frizzy? Is
mm-hmm.
that what it was?
There's a scene where my mom and I interact mm-hmm. In the play where there's always a hair scene for black women.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a scene where something to do with trying to figure out how to take care of my hair. And then particularly for women of color who have white mothers, a lot of the times our mothers may or may not know how to do our hair and struggle with that.
Right.
And particularly women of my age who are growing up in the 70s and 80s, there might not necessarily be an interaction with a community of color where she can get some training, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mom didn't have those access to those tools and struggled with my hair.
Okay.
So I have a scene all about a struggle between me and my mother in about my hair, and something really, really traumatic happens in the scene. And the scene is also about issues of not just issues of black womanhood and beauty, but also issues about what it means to be black and having people tell you that you're out of control and that you can't be controlled, or like, what's wrong with your hair? I can't take care of this. It's just mm-hmm. completely out of control. It's completely frizzy. And these are some of the things that my mother was saying to me at that time. And then something really traumatic happens in the scene. And then this is the piece that comes after it in the play. My mother did not know. Her voice was sometimes yellow, like the pain of her brush wrestling through my curls, needles on my forehead. She explains why she has blue eyes, is white, and my skin is brown. She brushes and murmurs, "It may be apples and oranges, but it's all fruit. But today, I am falling further than an apple can ever roll. The air between ground and branch separates my birth from my childhood, my birth mother from mother, my birth father from father. Sperm and egg are light years away from goodnight kisses, bedtime songs, walks to schools, kisses on scraped knees, broken hearts. If I hit the ground sharp enough, this descent between trees may redraw the rumor of my birth family across my back. Then suddenly, my birth mother's name appears. Typed old mimeograph-style purple on these court papers, blocked out like government secrets, leaves of information held away as far as branches will ever grow. My history is out at limb's end. I stretch my arms wide, wide, pulling shoulder muscles, overextending legs to reach sapling seeds, only to discover she does not want to be reminded I am alive. I clamor for truth and only find pieces suitable for the chainsaw of umbilical cords cut, tossed inside toxic bins without even a blood taste on her lips or a red line drawn across my forehead. It can't be good luck, her missing my naming. All I know is somehow my name still belongs to her, even though it's still lost in between these spaces, in between roots entwined with blood, tears, and flesh.
Wow. And it says in this article that to this day, you haven't talked to your mother about your Black identity. Is that true? She doesn't know about the play, Ungrateful Daughter?
We have had limited conversations about, well, of course they know about my Black identity. Of course they know that I'm a Black woman. We just don't talk about it a lot. It's just one of those things where, you know, I think that they're in their late 70s, you know, I'm in my 40s, and we like to go home and, you know, quilt together, and we like to have a good time together. Okay. And if we talk about race, if we talk about politics, if we talk about any, you know, there's a lot of things that at this point it's like, I can only do so much. And the continued pushing back to them, I can only do that so much. But I do it, and I do it quite a bit, and I do it enough already. And so, but for many years, they didn't want to talk about it. And it took I tell the story a lot. The first time that I ever remember my dad saying to me and acknowledging me as a Black woman was when I was 30. I was finishing up my first master's, and we went to Black graduation. We didn't go to the regular graduation. And, you know, my family was there amongst all the other families. And I think they really got to actually see the diversity of the African diaspora and how, you know, wide a diverse community we are. And my father, after graduation, said to me, you know, it's really just amazing to see you here as a Black woman. And I'm just amongst, you know, all of your community. And I'm just so proud of you to, you know, and see, and I still get all choked up about it. But it was the first time I ever heard anything like that and from him. So, you know, I know that they know, but I just think that, you know, they live in rural Washington State where there aren't really any people of color, and you know, they don't have television, and they basically just listen to the radio. And so, you know, that I think they just, their interactions and understanding race, it just isn't in the same way I think that we do here in the Bay Area, which I think is actually representative of most of America,
right?
Which is why, you know, I get scared when I think about the children that are being brought from Haiti to the United States and are being brought to places like Iowa and Kansas and, you know, where the Mormons are, Utah. And, you know, I get scared and really frightened thinking about the families that are, you know, fundamentalist Christian families that are really doing this out of, you know, an old school sense of the savior complex, and also really thinking about Haiti as a backwards, you know, devil infused country. And like the notion of like transforming these children into good Christians is really why they're adopting the children. And yeah, I really get frightened when I hear this. And this isn't to say all of the children are going to these families, but I really encourage folks to, you know, get support, because I think that your idea of what it means to adopt a child of color and the reality of it are two different things. And I think that people may or may not be prepared for the responses of their community, as particularly when their child turns 16 and becomes a young Black man. And then all of their notions about Black male identity are going to explode.
So that's why you've got this organization, I guess. And you want to talk a little bit about AFAD? And
AFAD is Adopted and Fostered Adults of the African Diaspora. And the work that we do is basically providing support for the African diasporic adoptee and foster care community. And we have meetings on a monthly basis for adopted adults and foster care alumni. And a lot of it is simply just support and being able to talk about our experiences, joyful experiences as well as painful experiences, and supporting around searching for birth families, supporting about negotiating birth families and adoptive families. And because there's a huge thing around loyalty and respect, and particularly in transracial adoptive families, whether or not we like to talk about it, there is a question of power and race that impacts the way that the question of gratefulness, and which is why the show is called Ungrateful Daughter, because it actually isn't about ungratefulness towards my parents. It's about this notion in the adoption community, same race or not, that adoptees need to be grateful because their lives would have been so much worse. And you would have been in foster care this whole time, and you would have been abandoned in your country far, far away. And I think that the work that we do in AFAD and also our collaboration with other international adoptee organizations, where we're all looking at this actual circumstances of adoption, and we're all looking at why mothers are having to give up their children. So that's also part of the work that we do at AFAD, is collaborate with other adoptee of color organizations that do work around advocacy for unwed mothers. Mm-hmm. And
so you're broadening the political picture so that people can see beyond just their own individual adoption or their own individual, if they've been adopted, to see the broader picture and also have be able to have coalitions with each other.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we've really tried to do is move beyond. There's a long history of folks just wanting to hear, you know, the plight of the transracial adoptee and their story. And even many of us who are professionals now still get calls from CNN or from the New York Times, where they just want to hear, you know, what was it like for you, you know, mm-hmm. as an adoptee? And we are saying, you know, we're actually more interested in this from a social justice perspective. And we're actually interested in the ways that families of color continue to be separated from one another, and the families are devalued mm-hmm. for basically other people's gain. The work that we're doing is trying to draw some attention and also trying to put it out into the social justice landscape.
But I just want to make sure people know about this show, Ungrateful Daughter, One Black Girl's Story of Being Adopted into a White Family That Aren't Celebrities, and that it's going to run through June 12th at the Stageworks Theater in San Francisco at 8 p.m. And people can find information about that through
at brownpapertickets.com.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lisa Marie Rollins, for joining us today and bringing up this story.
Thanks for having me.